All right, everyone, I think we'll get started. Thank you all for coming once again. This is the Socialism 2009 session, the Principles of Communism and the Communist Manifesto. Welcome. It'll run much like previous sessions. We'll have time for discussion after the presentation, of which Kurt Kruger will give. He's an ISO member in Los Angeles. Take it away, Kurt.
Okay. Let me first adjust my milk crate podium. That works much better. I don't know. I had a, thinking back about the presidential campaign, there's a lot of favorite moments for me, and I guess like one of my favorite ones was during the ridiculous debate about whether Barack Obama was indeed a socialist or not. And but thankfully, to clarify things, we had Barbara West, who is of Orlando's WFTV9 eyewitness news team, who I guess we're told is Orlando's news leader, who was like apparently that thought she was practicing adversarial journalism by trying to grill Joe Biden about, asking him why Obama wanted to redistribute Joe the plumber's wealth. And after she asked him that, she looked at him with a really sober look on her face and said to Joe Biden, "You may recognize this famous quote, 'From each according to his ability, to each according to his needs.' That's Karl Marx. How is Senator Obama not being a Marxist if he intends to spread the wealth around?" And Joe Biden's response, "Are you kidding? Are you joking? Or is that a real question?" And her response was, "No, it's a real question." Now, if you put aside the fact that West couldn't really even quote Marx accurately, or that for some strange reason she picked a quote that had nothing to do with redistribution of wealth at all, this one thing is like pretty clear by that is that what she's doing is what's constantly done by the right, which is perpetuate this myth about socialism, that it can be achieved by some charismatic figure that's bringing it about from above to the masses. Now, without a doubt, this idea about socialism was not helped at all by various Stalinist countries and countries that called themselves socialist but practiced very top-down methods. But this idea or notion that socialism can be achieved by electing Obama or some enlightened minority is a completely false one. As Karl Marx's friend and collaborator Frederick Engels put it, quote, "Our notion from the very beginning was that the emancipation of the working class must be the act of the working class itself." That is, that the working class is the first class in history that represents really a universal interest, and that in making a revolution can abolish all forms of undemocratic rule and class antagonisms. And it's not, and they can do this not because of some kind of grand ideas that of Karl Marx, but because of actually the role that workers play within the economic system. And for most writers and thinkers before the manifesto, and actually many since, the working class really doesn't exist in any meaningful way, and it certainly doesn't exist as an agent to its own emancipation. As the manifesto puts it in describing other socialists of Marx and Engels' time, "Only from the point of view of being the most suffering class does the proletariat exist for them." Now, having said that, even critics who are generally quite hostile to Marx and declare his ideas dead with every economic boom have actually started to heap praise upon him within the recent economic crisis. I mean, you've probably heard this before in many places like Time magazine and various Wall Street investors talking about how actually Marx was correct about the dynamic of capitalism. Heck, even the Pope was praising Marx for his what he called his great analytical skill. Marx's analysis, although it's rightly praised, especially when it's in comparison to typical mainstream economists who are really apologists for capitalism and therefore can't really give us any coherent analysis and way of analyzing what's going on with the system. But I must qualify by what I'm saying when I mean that they're heaping praise upon Marx. They're only giving him praise up to a certain point. His analytical skill is what's actually being praised, only to denounce his revolutionary conclusions, which is really the heart of what the manifesto is all about. And I think that's really why, you know, a meeting, probably that's why we're having a meeting on the Communist Manifesto. And I think that, you know, seeing how much it's in the news right now and then the dialogue, I think that we really need to come to grips with what the understanding of what Marxism and what Marx was really talking about, especially when those try to smear him and his ideas. So I just want to put all of the manifesto in historic context, because it came out of a certain time and a place. It didn't just come out of midair. So the Communist Manifesto was first published in 1848 when Marx was 29 years old and Engels was 27, and it was literally just before a revolutionary period swept throughout Europe. And really, the proletariat of Marx and Engels' time was relatively small in what it's in comparison to the size of it today. The manifesto describes the term proletariat, which we would call a working class, as composed of what it calls laborers who must sell themselves piecemeal and are a commodity like every other article of commerce, and are consequently exposed to all the vicissitudes of competition, to all the fluctuations of the market. So by this definition, anyone that does not own the own means of production and has to sell their labor in order to survive is generally working class, and that is the vast majority of the world's population today, with few exceptions, really is a worker. So that includes teachers, nurses, computer programmers, and all others. They're all alike forced or having the aspects of commodification, pressures of the market, dynamics of the business cycle, and the profit motive. They all feel that pressure in a very similar way. At Marx's time, though, his observations were at the earliest stages of the formation of the working class. So in the opening lines of the manifesto that goes, "A specter is haunting Europe, the specter of communism," this was really a bold statement, but was really at the time more based on desire than on reality. Although it probably didn't help much that the original English translation was translated into, "A frightful hobgoblin stalks throughout Europe. We are haunted by a ghost, the ghost of communism." And luckily, Engels was able to help retranslate that back to its correct form later. So when Marx and Engels met in London, in the Soho area of London, to write the manifesto, there was only really a handful of people that were there. And it was the headquarters of the German Workers' Educational Association, which was a gathering of mostly exiled intellectuals and radicals that called itself the Communist League. The League decided that it needed open pronouncement of its views to distribute, and in December of 1847, they gave Marx and Engels the task of writing that document. Although the path to the first edition of the Communist Manifesto was not really an easy one. When Marx got back from London to Belgium, he had a number of distractions, writing different articles and speeches, and really was given pressure by the Central Committee to, hey, you really need to get this done. And he did, which ended up really creating the entire document really in only a few days. So if you think about that, he wrote this in only a few days, which ended up having such a huge impact throughout the world. So, you know, maybe that can give you inspiration the next time you have a big, you know, deadline and procrastinate similarly. But now I want to turn to the manifesto itself, because it's worth repeating that Marx and Engels lived at a time when capitalism was relatively young, and therefore they were really able to analyze the essential features of the system. And I think through this, the manifesto does not merely offer a description of the way that the capitalist system is, but it also gives really prediction about the dynamics of capitalism, while at the same time offering us a prescription for action. The manifesto charts off and really even praises capitalism and talking about how it's unleashed the power of human productivity. It says, "The bourgeoisie, during its rule of scarce 100 years, has created more massive, more colossal productive forces than have all preceding generations together. The subjection of nature's forces to man, machinery, application of chemistry, to industry and agriculture, steam navigation, railways, electric telegraphs, clearing of whole continents for cultivation, canalization of rivers, whole populations conjured out of the ground. What earlier century could even have a presentiment that such productive forces slumbered in the lap of social labor. So why really praise capitalism in a document that you later are going to propose its overthrow? Well, I think it's because, you know, for Marx and Engels, it's that development of those productive forces that brought about, that capitalism brings about, which provides the material conditions to really get rid of those inequalities that capitalism brings about. But Marx also had his critics of the time, similar like in the election of John McCain and Sarah Palin, talking about why do you want to spread the wealth? And Marx responded to those critics directly in the manifesto by saying, "You are horrified at our intending to do away with private property. But in your existing society, private property is already done away with for 9/10 of the population. Its existence for the few is solely due to its non-existence in the hands of those 9/10. In one word, you reproach us with intending to do away with your property." Precisely so. That is what we just intend. So we should clarify what Marx, though, is talking about when he says private property, because he's not talking about personal possessions or, you know, taking away your bike or your toothbrush or anything like that at the right, like, you know, likes to scare us into. But he's talking about the ownership of property, which one person actually commands the labor of another person through exploitation. Marx goes on to explain how economic crises, though, are also inherent to capitalism, and that capitalism, that capitalist system that he's praising, though, it also has a flaw. The problem is, with capitalism is that with all of that innovation and energy, all of this is unplanned and it overproduces. As Marx put it in the manifesto, "Modern bourgeois society, with its relations of production, exchange, property, a society that has conjured up such gigantic means of production and of exchange, is like the sorcerer who is no longer able to control the powers of the netherworld, which whom he is called upon by his spells." Now, you listen to this quote, and then you think about AIG and Bear Stearns and, you know, all their credit default swaps and collateralized debt obligations, all these, like, very complex financial instruments that they thought they had such a good grasp over, and now, all of a sudden, they're losing control out of it, and it's threatening the entire system in general. He goes on from this. It is enough to mention the commercial crisis that by their periodic return put the existence of the entire bourgeois society on trial. In these crises, a great part, not only of the existing products, but also of the previously created productive forces, are periodically destroyed. In these crises, there breaks out an epidemic that in all earlier epochs would have seemed an absurdity, the epidemic of overproduction. Society suddenly finds itself put back into a state of momentary barbarism. It appears as if a famine, a universal war of devastation, has cut off the supply of every means of subsistence. Industry and commerce seem to be destroyed. And why? Because there is too much civilization, too much means of subsistence, too much industry, too much commerce. However, it's not that there's too much to meet human need. I mean, Marx also goes on to describe how people go hungry while there is an abundance of food, that people go without shelter while there's plenty of homes that are just sitting empty, and why many people are out of work when society desperately needs labor to perform very needed societal tasks. In other words, it's not profitable, though, to feed people that are hungry and give shelter to people that are poor. So, therefore, because it's not profitable to feed or give them shelter, it's better to dump that thousands of pounds of grain into the ocean every year, or to let perfectly good houses sit empty while there's people that are homeless on the street. And it's that irrational logic of capitalism that's at the center of the current economic crisis, right? Too many houses. Not too many houses for people, though, that need shelter. It's too many houses to sell for a profit. And I think, because of this, we're having to go through what he describes in the manifesto as that universal war of devastation, of people that are losing their homes and losing their jobs, just to destroy enough capital to actually correct the system and get the free market working again. Capitalism also, though, creates wealth and power in the hands of a small minority. And it creates huge pools of poverty, and it turns life really into a daily grind that rather than, you know, people fulfilling their potential, they actually, you know, feel very isolated. And at the same time, it also is enormously wasteful and creates economic crisis. So just one example of how, you know, capitalism creates this vast inequality is that just this one statistic I was just reading is fewer than 500 people around the world own more than the combined income of over half the planet's population. And, you know, I thought that was like startling worldwide. And then I was just at Joel Geyer's talk, and he was talking about how Warren Buffett and his family own or have more money than a third of the people in this country, which is absolutely ridiculous. And it's not hard also to understand how the rich have acquired their wealth. I mean, in the mid-1960s, wages for manufacturing jobs in the United States were equal to about 46% of the value added after production. By 1990, this figure dropped to about 36%. So in other words, the capitalist class is making us work harder and longer for less money. And it's even leaving those that generally consider themselves middle class only a paycheck away, generally, from poverty. So capitalism encourages greed, it encourages competition, and it also degrades human relations between people to what Marx calls in the manifesto that it's, human relations are little more than naked self-interest and a callous cash payment. So it's really little wonder why the economist Juliet Shore wrote that what she says, 30% of adults say that they experience high stress nearly every day. Even higher numbers report high stress once or twice a week. Americans are literally working themselves to death, as jobs contribute to heart disease, hypertension, gastric problems, exhaustion, and a variety of ailments. Capitalism's drive to expand not only stabilizes social relations, but sooner or later it also undermines its own ability for economic growth. Marx and Engels argue that capitalism is a system that is highly destructive, and you know where the crisis that we're going through now is not an exception, you know, to the rule, but is the rule, and that they're unavoidable. So, in a world that is threatened by pollution, global warming, and the destruction of the variety of ecosystems because of this uncontrolled capitalist growth, I think like a lot of this is starting to make sense to people, especially in the context of an economic crisis. Capitalist society today has also raised production to the point where everybody could be provided with a decent life, you know, enough to eat, a comfortable place to live, health care, decent education, and so forth. But as Marx and Engels point out in the manifesto, they say the conditions of the bourgeois society are too narrow to comprise the wealth created by them. So each successive crisis that ends up happening under capitalism can only be overcome by what they call paving the way for more extensive and more destructive crises. And but I think like the larger point like, of all that analysis that Marx had made, the manifesto is really a revolutionary call to action. And it doesn't only explain what's wrong in general with society, but actually how we can transform it and to create a society in which they call in the manifesto an association in which the free development of each is a condition for the free development of all. So the fundamental argument in the manifesto is that capitalism has created the problems that cannot be solved within the capitalist system itself. But at the same time, capitalism has also created the class of people that through making a revolution can actually solve these problems. Capitalism has created, really in the words of the manifesto, its own gravedigger. That's the working class. Marx and Engels argue that capitalism has created a group of people with both the capacity and the interest to fight to overthrow the existing system and really to emancipate all of humanity. The power of the working class is based on the fact that capitalism ends up socializing the labor process, bringing workers together in much larger and larger urban centers and in bigger and bigger units of production. At the same time, the pressures of economic life tend to put workers together, and they tend to fight back whenever the economic system and wages are pushed down. And it's because of that key economic position within capitalism that I was describing before, they actually have the ability to be able to shut down all production with the weapon of the strike. Now, of course, most workers don't begin with the idea or the goal of making a revolution. And quite understandably, many seek to make change first, starting off within the confines of the existing system. But in the process of undertaking such efforts, they're either frustrated by defeat or seeing their limited gains that they make, or even seeing the gains that they made being taken away. But in this entire fight to really protect their own interests, Marx and Engels talk about the collisions between individual working men and individual bourgeoisie take more and more of the character of collisions that are between classes. And it's also worth saying, too, that the working class is not perpetually on the verge of a revolution. For long periods of time, many workers will accept their lot in life under capitalism. I think a big reason for this is, like, as the manifesto says, of course, the ruling ideas of any society are that of its ruling class. But as Marx and Engels also understood, that this state of affairs wouldn't last forever, because the chaotic, the unplanned character, and the development of capitalist economies eventually throws all societies into turmoil, and eventually turns even the most modest of working class demands into a challenge against the whole system. And to say that, it doesn't mean that this process is a smooth one. I mean, the ruling class uses many ways to try to attempt to divide and conquer the working class by really exacerbating racial, ethnic differences, as well as a variety of other differences. But such divisions can be fought, and they can be overcome through struggle, where different groups of people that are constantly pitted against each other see that through that struggle they have a similar class interest in fighting against that boss or whoever that oppressor may be. The working class can, in making that revolution, both transform itself, which is a necessary part of the revolutionary process, but it can also transform society in general. So I think what's also important is that the Communist Manifesto also talks about how socialists really have a key role to play in this process. And so, as Marx writes in the Manifesto, communists are distinguished from other working class parties by this. He states, first, in the national struggles of the proletarians of the different countries, they point out and bring in front common interests of the entire proletariat, independently of all nationality. Second, in the various stages of development in which the struggle of the working class against the bourgeoisie has to pass through, they are always and everywhere represent the interest of the whole movement. The communists, therefore, are on the one hand practically the most advanced, resolute section of the working class parties of every country, that section which pushes forward all others. And I think here what you really see is an embryonic form from Marx is what Lenin would later go on to develop about the idea of the centrality of the revolutionary party, where you're putting together the most militant workers together in a political party to play a leadership role in those different struggles. Now, there's many people that have arguments against the Communist Manifesto, and one of the main criticisms that I think you'll typically hear about the Manifesto is that it suggests that socialism is somehow inevitable. But in actuality, the Manifesto just really lays out a set of principles, and it's clear that it must be applied differently in different historic circumstances. So in other words, in different times and places, it would be applied differently. So with Marx and Engels, they wrote a new preface to the Manifesto in 1872 that said, "The practical applications of the principles will depend, as the Manifesto states, everywhere and at all times on the historical conditions for the time being existing, and for that reason, no special stress is laid on the revolutionary measures proposed at the end of Section 2. That passage would, in many respects, be very different than worded today." And, also, not only that, but far from, being inevitable, even the Manifesto in its original form says that a very, real danger that has happened and could happen in history is that you could have the common ruin of the contending classes in any revolutionary struggle. Another argument that you probably typically hear is that workers could never bring about a new society. And there's a variety of reasons that people have for this, whether, people are just too naturally selfish and greedy. The fall of the Soviet Union proves that socialism doesn't work. Workers are no longer really a meaningful part of our society. We live in a post-industrial age. Marxism is out of date. You know, that type of thing. I won't go through every one of these arguments, but I just want to stress a more basic point through all of them, is that Marx's theory of working class revolution did not come about as a result of some just scheme or fantasy on his part, but it came about as a result of observing the real struggles of workers that were going on under capitalism and trying to figure out ways to advance those struggles that he was observing. Now, Marx was able to do this not because he was a theorist, but because he was an activist. I mean, he wasn't just sitting in the library like a lot of people think, you know, trying to figure out the way that capitalism works. Marx spent his entire adult life really trying to build organizations, both with unions and socialist organizations, and was even on the barricades of the bourgeois revolutions of the 19th century. He also helped form the International Working Man's Association and really actively tried to recruit and build it. So since Marx's ideas about revolution came from struggle and changed with struggle, he was often very dismissive of theorists such as the utopian socialists, who he writes about in the manifesto, who created these models for societies based on actually a retreat from capitalism or a return to some romanticized earlier period in human history. But in either case, it was undisturbed by the actual participation of the working class in those periods. So for Marx, the class struggle, which is sometimes open, it's sometimes hidden, is a constant feature of class society, but under capitalism, it takes a new form. Under capitalism, for the first time, the class comes into being in that in struggling to overcome its own exploitation, as it's repeatedly compelled to do, it has the potential to make the revolution that would not only replace one form of exploitation of one minority by another minority, but actually overthrow and replace a minority by a majority of workers. So it was very different than, say, the other revolutions prior to that, say, where you had an overthrow of the bourgeois class of the feudal society so that you still had one minority still controlling society. Under socialism, Marx describes how there will be no bureaucracy, no standing army, and that officials will be elected and subjected to instant recall, and that political officials will earn the wage of the average workers. These are ideas that he didn't just pull out of midair or invent. These are ideas that came out of the democratic gains of the communards during the Paris Commune before they were brutally suppressed. And in making that revolution that Marx is describing, he thought that people could unleash human creativity and human possibility. Things that we couldn't really even imagine today because of the limits that are really placed and imposed upon us through the different pressures and dynamics of capitalism and this idea that things are sort of always constant and the world is fixed and inevitable. So why, I guess, people are probably wondering why that the other part of the talk, the name of the title, other than the Communist Manifesto, The Principles of Communism. Well, I just want to go into that briefly. The title of the manifesto has Marx and Engels as co-authors of it, and rightfully so, but evidence really suggests that Marx was the sole author that wrote the final draft of the document. And even though throughout their careers, Marx and Engels were perfectly fine in penning different documents and articles in their own individual names and not in collaboration, there was this joint credit of the manifesto. And why was that? Well, I think that the basis of this joint authorship is based upon a short document that Engels had written in 1847 that was called The Principles of Communism. And this is really a brilliant piece. I think that people should read it. It's in Phil Gaspar's edition of the Communist Manifesto, but it really lays out the first formulations of many of the key passages that Marx would later use to create the Communist Manifesto. The kernel of the manifesto can really be found here, and Engels writes it in a question and answer format of 25 different questions. And some of the questions are, what is communism? What is the proletariat? Will it be possible for communist revolution to take place in one country alone? And actually, to answer this question of whether a revolution can happen in one country alone, Engels offers a one-word sentence before he elaborates on it, which is no. And so, I mean, this is just one of, like, you know, many examples of how, like, Joseph Stalin and the, you know, bureaucratic dictatorial regimes that later claimed to speak for revolutionary socialism really took that theory of international working class self-emancipation completely on its head. Marx owed, you know, a great deal of intellectual depth to Engels, but not only for that, the principles of communism, but also from an earlier work which helped develop, Engels developed the principles of communism, which was called The Condition of the Working Class in England in 1844, which was really a critical text that helped develop the basic Marxist idea that workers were the agent of change and not merely oppressed creatures that could be rescued by this or that would-be reformer. And Engels was able to explain this in the Principles of Communism by answering question by question, what is the proletariat, but also what makes them different from a variety of other types of workers that are oppressed, whether it be slaves, serfs, handicraftsmen, and manufacturing workers. And again, I just really encourage everyone to read this, but I'll just give one example because I think it really shows the depth and the clarity that Engels had in being able to explain these different things. So when answering the question, in what way do the proletarians differ from slaves, he said, the slave is sold once and for all. The proletarian must sell himself daily and hourly. The individual slave, property of one master, is assured an existence, however miserable it may be, because of the master's interest. The individual proletariat property is, as it were, of the entire bourgeois class, which buys his labor only when someone actually needs it, has no secure existence. This existence is assured only to the class as a whole. The slave is outside of competition. The proletariat is in it and experiences all of its vagaries. The slave counts as one thing, not a member of society. Thus, the slave can have a better existence than the proletarian, while the proletarian belongs to a higher stage of social development and himself stands on a higher social level than the slave. The slave frees himself when of all relations of private property, he abolishes the relations of slavery and thereby becomes a proletarian. The proletariat can free himself only by abolishing private property in general. And like Marx and Engels, Engels came to these ideas of revolutionary conclusions about the agent of the working class, also not because of his, you know, studies in the library, but because his real connection with the working class Chartist movement that was in England in the 1840s and his exposure to factory life in Manchester. And really through this, Engels got a glimpse of really the earlier formations of the working class that Marx didn't have in Germany, and really the revolutionary character of capitalism, and again, that proletariat that capitalism therefore created. So, did Marx get everything in the manifesto right? No, absolutely not. Several of his formations were overly optimistic and substituting really a desired outcome for reality. Nonetheless, though, it's remarkable how correct these fundamental arguments that the manifesto remains. And in a speech, just an example of this, a speech a couple of years ago by Jeffrey Sachs, who was a director of the Earth Institute at Columbia University, points this out. He said, malaria is a disease that would kill 2 million children this year, overwhelmingly in Africa. 2 million children. Now, this is a disease that is largely preventable and 100% treatable. And treatment costs 80 cents. But people are so poor that 2 million kids are going to die this year because they don't even get access to the simplest things, like a bed net treated with insecticide that would protect them from this disease. Now here's the basic arithmetic of our time. There are 300 million places in Africa, sleeping sites where people are vulnerable to being bitten by mosquitoes carrying malaria. 300 million. Each bed net costs $5. That's 1.5 billion. Yet almost none of these children sleep under a bed net because they're too poor. But what is $1.5 billion in today's world? That is the amount of money we spend each day on the Pentagon. That's our daily military budget. And even before all these big Wall Street bonuses that were going out this past year, the top 25 investment fund managers in the United States were making $14 billion just in personal income. And I think Paul Krugman really puts it well, sort of like, the era that we're living in right now, where he just said right before even the entire economic bust of the past fall, income inequality is now fully back to the Gilded Age. Consider a head-to-head comparison. We know that John D. Rockefeller, the richest man in the Gilded Age America, made in 1894 because in 1895 he had to pay income taxes. His return declared an income of $1.25 million, almost 7,000 times the average per capita income in the United States at the time. But that makes him a mere piker by modern standards. Last year, according to the Institute's Investors Alpha magazine, James Simons, a hedge fund manager, took home $1.7 billion. That's more than 38,000 times the average income. Two other hedge fund managers also made more than $1 billion. And the top 25 combined made $14 billion. How much is $14 billion? It's more than it would cost to provide health care for a year to 8 million children. The number of children in the United States who, unlike children in other advanced countries, don't have health care. The hedge fund billionaires are simply extreme examples of the bigger phenomenon. Every available measure of income concentration shows that we've gone back to the levels of inequality not seen since the 1920s. And I think if you just look at recently at the most recent UN reports that suggest that global climate change only exacerbates divisions that's going on between countries. And I think in the process of all this, of destroying a large deal of the planet, it also threatens human life. Because through this constant drive for profit and accumulation, it can actually spill over into larger, more military conflicts. And it has so many different consequences, such as the armament for nuclear arms and so forth, that can really have extremely destructive damages. Yet, as the manifesto reminds us, it's created for the first time the ability to really do away with all that scarcity and all that inequality and all the stuff that I was talking about earlier. So, okay. So I think that one of the things that is great about the manifesto is that what it states is actually a vision of what it is that we are fighting for. So it's not suggesting that we, just stand on the sidelines and denounce any of the struggles for reforms or anything like that, but actually actively engage those different struggles and that are for reforms, but also try to push them even further when they and advocate for more solutions that actually go beyond the limit that capitalism provides. And so I think in closing, I just want to talk about how Marx and Engels really have been proven right over and over again. And because workers around the world in many different countries that where no one predicted there would be a revolution because of either how repressive the different regimes have been toppled. And even in the United States, often where the rich history of struggle and of socialist tradition is really often suppressed. 1 million people in America ended up voting for Eugene Debs in 1920. The Black Panther Party, for example, along with their different political activism, made it mandatory reading that everyone reads the Communist Manifesto. But I think that the socialist tradition here has also been marked by these big levels of discontinuity. So you have massive struggles, then sort of large times that seem relatively calm. So you have the 1930s and the 60s, and then you have other eras like the 50s and the 80s, where it doesn't seem like much is happening at all. Although none of these periods of radicalizations fully fulfilled its potential, like the 1930s or the 1960s, these eventual falls of these movements were by no means predestined in any real way. And there's nothing inherent or, predestined about any movement being doomed from the very beginning. And I think that, when we kind of wonder whether there will be any new struggle that it's in the future, I think one of the really good ways of summing this up was this economist at Cornell, Robert Frank, who said, "History has repeatedly demonstrated that societies can tolerate income inequality only up to a point, beyond which they rapidly disintegrate. Numerous governments in Latin America have been overthrown largely because of the social unrest rooted in income inequality. Major social upheavals are sometimes preceded by years or even decades of rising levels of social unrest. If such unrest exists currently in the United States, it remains well hidden. But as recent experience has made clear, social upheavals often occur with virtual no warning. Almost no one predicted the fall of the Eastern European governments in 1989. Because revolutions are almost always entail important elements of social unrest, even small changes can launch political prairie fires once a tipping point has been reached. And we have very much seen these type of prairie fires that get set off with, say, the passage of Prop 8 or the massive immigration marches of just a few years ago. So again, I really just want to underscore that there's nothing inevitable about how these struggles will eventually end up playing themselves out. There's never any guarantees throughout history, as the manifesto lays out. But there's only one inevitability, that is, if we don't struggle, we will face more economic crisis that will occur in the future, and pretty soon they'll be really hard to overcome because of this very drastic consequences. I think it also in this new period that we have, we're going to see an increase in the level of political radicalization. And then with that, really, probably more people are going to be picking up the Communist Manifesto and are going to find interest in it. So I just wanted to end with a quote by the British socialist Eric Hobsbawm, who I think really captures the significance of the Communist Manifesto when he says, "Whenever there is trouble in anywhere in the world, the book becomes an item. When things quiet down, the book drops out of sight, and when there's trouble again, the people who forgot remember. When people dream of resistance, even if they're not communists, even if they distrust communists, it provides music for their dreams." Thank you.
Thank you, Kurt. That was excellent. So we're going to open it up to discussion now. And yeah, I will take people down if they raise their hands. I forgot to introduce myself. I'm Sarasvati. I'm a member of ISO in Los Angeles. So if people can just say their name and where they're from, and feel free to raise your hand while other people are speaking, and try to speak up even though it's a fairly small room, but make sure people can hear you. I'll take the gentleman in the hat.
My question was asked to the how a revolution should play out according to the Communist Manifesto. On one hand, the way that it's usually framed in socialist discussions is that you look to the working class in disadvantaged country X, Y, or Z, and hope that the exploited workers in that country will become class conscious and rise up. However, one of the first things out of Marx's mouth is that communism is an international movement, and that it should exist beyond borders and eventually destroy all of those borders for the betterment of mankind. How is it then that we are supposed to look to specific countries rather than the unification of the working class throughout the world?
Okay, thank you.
Hi, Patrick, San Francisco. I had a question, if you could just comment on any relationship or what Marx had to say about anarchism and how those two kind of interplayed back and forth, especially during that time where anarchism was, you know, played a big role during that same time where Marx wrote the Communist Manifesto.
Great. Kurt may or may not come back in during the discussion, but feel free to answer other people's questions or bring up more. An open list. Go ahead, sir.
Just to relate to that question about anarchism, and Marx on anarchism, I think that the first thing Marx wrote about it that I know of is The Poverty of Philosophy, which was an answer to Proudhon, the father of anarchism, one of the fathers of anarchism, his book, The Philosophy of Poverty. Basically, from what I can tell is the idea of anarchism is counterposed to the idea of democracy, because the anarchist is about individual freedom, regardless of what anybody else is into, whereas democracy is about all of us making the decisions together democratically. And if you're, you know, majority rules and so forth. So that's a quick answer to that. I'm sure somebody else would do better.
Thank you. I have Ray. Did you raise your hand at the back?
No.
Oh, you didn't. I'm sorry. Maybe it was you in the brown jacket.
Uh-huh. Yeah, I'm Dan Smith over tonight. I haven't been in the manifesto for a while, so brilliant work. There's one thing about it. I didn't think this kind of disturbed me when I read it. My sometimes points out a contradiction in what the bourgeoisie says and what they do, and it's, you know, it's wrong. Is a contradiction. I'm not sure which side he's really on. Like the private property thing that you just brought up was that bourgeoisie says they're going to take away your private property, but they already have taken it away. And that could be interpreted to mean either we shouldn't have private property, or it should be equally distributed. And another thing was on the sexual monogamy. Marx pointed out that the bourgeoisie preached that to the working class, but didn't practice it in their personal lives. So did that mean Marx was really for or against monogamy? And it wasn't clear to me. There's some other examples too, and I understood the brilliance of his argument, of his technique, but I felt kind of like maybe even cheated by not being crystal clear as to which side some of these issues might be on.
Okay, David?
I'm Dave from Chicago. I'm pretty sure that he's not talking about taking the property of the rich people and distributing it equally, because that would still be private property, except in fractions, right? And we often do make examples of, you know, how impossible it is to take a piece of a factory. It's a thing that comes as a big chunk and would have to be owned collectively if it isn't owned privately. I'm not gonna handle the question of marriage that you brought up. I hope somebody else can. I wanted to talk about internationalism, the question of the fact that that. Even though socialism is from the very beginning has an international outlook, the struggles break out very often on a national basis. But it's important to realize that from the very start, Marxism was an international outlook, because it was written at a time when revolutions were breaking out in Europe, and they were anticipating a spread of revolution from one country to the next. And throughout their career, they believed that revolutions would be interconnected. It was always a concrete question how they would be interconnected. They were, for example, the independence of Ireland, which would be coordinated with a working class uprising in England as well. So that they're always thinking of how to coordinate struggles internationally. And the first international working men's association that they founded helped people warn each other from France to Britain when they sent up a call for scabs. If there was a strike in Britain, there would be advertisements. The factory owners would put advertisements in the newspapers in France for people to come for jobs in Britain, but they didn't say you're going to be breaking a strike. Now, the international put their own ads right next to them saying, oh, you know, help out your brothers internationally. So that it's always a concrete question how these things are coordinated, but the fact is they said in the manifesto, I'm going to finish on this, that each working class has to settle scores with its national bourgeoisie in order to play its role in an international revolution. And I think that's because the structures of the economics and capital in the first place are first nationally based, but also the forces of the state are organized. Those are the forces of repression that are going to keep you down are organized state by state, and you have to deal with that and replace that with a democratic structure. That's the first building block of a spread of a socialist revolution internationally.
Okay.
Thank you. My name is John. I'm from LA. I'll take up just in a nutshell, and maybe if people want to expand on it, we can talk about the difference between anarchism and what Marx was laying out. But I think the key to it, in terms of what was laid out in the Communist Manifesto, was this question that people probably heard before, is like, the dictatorship of the proletariat. And it's sort of like, what does that mean? You just said dictatorship. We've seen dictatorships of military personnel and dictatorships of what Marx talked about in under capitalism, the dictatorship of the bourgeoisie. Which means there's certain level of police presence in our society, the jails and even the death penalty in certain countries that will remain nameless. But there's the idea of dictatorship. What he's really talking about is the power, right, of class. Because what he's laying out in the Communist Manifesto is that all of human history has been the history of class struggle that you have under certain circumstances. And he doesn't just talk about capitalism, he goes or feudalism or other social relations and societies in history, and talks about the different classes that contend with one another, with lords, basically exploiting the peasants, as well as, when he describes capitalism, the bourgeoisie exploiting the workers. And that what he's talking about and where he differs with anarchists is this idea that when the workers overthrow the old order in the revolution, that they'll actually have to institute, for the time being, a control over the productive forces in society to prevent the reimposition of the dictatorship of the bourgeoisie. And that's a difference with the anarchist conception generally on the theoretical level. So it's that idea of basically having what he would consider a worker state. As long as there's classes in society that are in opposition, a state is going to be necessary so that these classes don't just consume each other into a common ruin of contending classes, as Kurt put out there. But then something that he mentions it's in the Communist Manifesto, I believe, that the state actually is going to wither away as classes wither away. When you have the majority class in control that doesn't exploit another class because it's producing, this is the first time that the ruling class is not dependent on the labor of another class, it is the laboring class. It runs society. That it will no longer need a state to manage these affairs of one class exploiting another because the class that rules is the producing class. And that state will just wither away. And that's actually where we have, I guess, a similarity in goals with anarchism. So I don't know if that helps to answer the question. It's very theoretical, I'm sorry, but I just figure it's worth addressing.
I was wondering if it was possible as a modern, I was curious as to the collective answer, whether in the modern world, that idea that each working class has to contend with its own bourgeoisie is still strictly relevant in a world of globalization and bourgeois institutions like the UN, which will defend the bourgeoisie's interests on an international level. So you don't really just, it seems to me at least, that we don't really just have to contend with our own bourgeoisie, but you have to contend with the bourgeoisie of the world. Ergo, perhaps some sort of workers, unified workers world, workers movement of the world is necessary, and how this fits into the modern complex system.
Go ahead.
Yeah,
I'm curious, whether, not having a lot of historical knowledge right now, but whether revolutions in countries that have taken on socialism, like Russia and Cuba and so forth, how explicitly, I think maybe a lot of folks might bring down Cuba, how explicitly did they cite or look towards the Communist Manifesto for their structure and for their revolution and the and for setting up the society after the revolution. And so they explicitly look at the Communist Manifesto and how well did they seem to follow it, or did they, how successful have they been?
Okay.
Person
in the red shirt there.
Danny McGinnity from Ireland. I wonder could the speaker elaborate a bit more on the whole struggle between anarchism and Marxism, which kind of started at that time. And I noticed that America and the anarchism still has a fair bit of traction here. It has another book, it's still pretty there. And it's not discussed a whole lot, and it's not that well documented. It probably should be. Maybe we talk about it.
The Communist Manifesto, Marx describes religion as the yoke of the masses. And one of the things United States. In the Communist Manifesto, of course, everyone knows. Marx describes religion as the opium of the masses. And one of the things that's very difficult about organizing the American working class, in particular, and worldwide, perhaps with the exception of Western Europe, is that religious folk, for the most part, find the ideas of communism somewhat anathema. And I mean, this has been popularized by people like Thomas Frank and What's the Matter with Kansas. And I'm just wondering, it's nice to be here in San Francisco and talking about these ideas, but when I go back to Oregon, where I'm from, and are dealing with students from, rural Oregon, it is really hard for them to get past this kind of false consciousness that's been imposed upon them by this kind of religious indoctrination. And I'm just wondering, the sectarian parts of the world, which is the overwhelming majority, how do we work through that without alienating, the working class, which seems to be incredibly religious?
Okay.
Take the mic
again. Go ahead.
I'm Claire from Iowa, and another thing that I'm so glad that you brought that up, because I also had a question about the religious aspect of it. It seems to me like all of the discussion here is taking place in a context of just sort of assumed atheism. Like, the issue of how religion, along with, and I brought this up in other discussions, racism, sexism, and homophobia, will persist even with the abolishment of class society. And I also just think it's interesting that the concepts put forth by Feuerbach in The Essence of Christianity, sort of emancipating human potential, and use of these words, human creativity and human possibility, those are not materialist concepts. Those are ideal. They are in the realm of philosophy. Crucial to his argument against class society, that liberating the working class and abolishing class society in the state will allow people to develop their full human potential as they wish. And that is also humanism as, put forth by Feuerbach, that religion is separation of what is essentially our best human potential, like onto a thing, a separate thing, which is God. Like, God is the non-physical, I guess, like spiritual embodiment of like our ideal humanity. And so if we can bring that back into ourselves as human, no one is discussing.
Good questions.
Go ahead. Hi, I'm Zakia from San Diego. There's a lot of good questions out there. I'll try to take on what I can in the time I have. The issue of, I'll take religion first. Marx also said religion was the heart of people. So I think that quote about opium of the masses, of course, is the well-known one, but I'm not an expert on Marxism, but I know that within the ISO and sort of my philosophy towards religion is that it is a private matter and not a state matter. and that people should be free to be spiritual or religious in any way they see fit. It's when religious ideals, and that's specific religions, you know, and interfere with other people's liberty, that becomes a problem. Let's say in the LGBT movement. Again, in the LGBT movement, there's a huge number, at least in San Diego, a lot of people are super religious. Like, they're Unitarians, they're part of, you know, certain Methodist sects, etc. So I don't see it. I see where other people see a conflict between religion and socialism, but for me, I see that I'm very comfortable with the two living in the same space. The idea that racism and homophobia will still exist in a society without class, and that's true, I think, especially in the earliest stages, but I think a society that doesn't have an interest in using race to divide people will be a less racist society. So, for instance, like, you know, when you have a bunch of white workers and they go on strike, you call in a bunch of black workers to take their job, or in the U.S., how you have immigrant labor, which is perceived to take the jobs of people who have citizenship status. There's an interest for the ruling class to create that division. And you have a society that doesn't have an interest in that, then my belief is that there will be less racism and that people will learn to live without racism. And I think, like, with all things, even if you're looking at whether it's religion in the U.S. and the difficulty of organizing the U.S., or, you know, racism and homophobia, these things aren't static. Like, we've come really far even in my lifetime, on issues of racism, homophobia, etc. So people's minds do change, you know, and even people's concept of what religion is has changed, and what the ideals of any particular, religion used to be used against black people in a way that's very different now. I just see it as, you know, the whole dialectic thing, that anything is possible, especially when you take away the barriers for us all to be treated equally.
Okay, I just want to say, I'm sorry, I have you down on the list, okay. But I have someone else before you.
Well, I spoke before,
it's not, you'll be on too, the woman in the brown hair.
Oh, okay, well, just going along with the question of, you know, the persistence of, like, you know, racism, homophobia, sexism, religion, I have problems, like, addressing this question as well, like, there's this issue, and I just go back and forth on, like, you know, how is the revolution change those things. Oh, how is the revolution going to change those things? And I kind of think about how if we have this, you know, class struggle, this revolution, then I think that's just a starting point, and that's what we have to realize. Like, lots of times people, you know, like socialists or Marxists will say, like, you know, we'll have this revolution, it's all inclusive, therefore these things, you know, just as like a byproduct of it will, you know, kind of almost be eradicated just because they're not backed up by, you know, capitalist motives for division, stuff like that. So I don't know, I just think that after the revolution, that's the starting point, and we need to, like, take into account, like, the specific ways that people of color need to have their issues addressed. You know, people, maybe queer people, just all kinds of groups, women, just stuff like that. So just like in terms of education, for example, like just how the standardized tests, they're clearly, like, you know, biased towards, like, you know, the white population, and just that, you know, reason for, like, the whole achievement gap and stuff like that. So just like in that way, how this is a white supremacist society, and in order to, you know, survive in this society, you have to, like, basically, like, submit to, like, whiteness and stuff like that. So I don't know, I just think that taking into account just, you know, every group's specific issues that needs to be done, even like post-revolution.
Okay, and the black shirt in the back.
Okay, what you were saying before, I was thinking the same thing. When you talked about the opiate of the masses, it's one of those things that everybody remembers one phrase from, and the whole passage has so much more to say. And he said it was the opiate of the people is the last sense. He talks about religion is the sigh of the oppressed creature, a heart in a heartless world, a soul of soulless conditions. Which is to say, it's a natural outgrowth of the fact that people are alienated from themselves. in a capitalist society. You're not going to get rid of it by saying, don't do that, it's bad. You're getting rid of it by getting people active in remaking their own world. And in the course of remaking their own world, in the course of taking power over their own lives, they eliminate the alienation that they feel. Whether they wind up still believing in a God or not is really, it's irrelevant. It's what you do in the world that matters. And in the course of remaking your world, you remake yourself. And on the, there's one other thing. The, the struggle against sexism, racism, homophobia, and all of that is not that after the revolution all these problems will be solved. A revolution can't succeed unless the working class is united as a class to make that revolution. And it's the struggle against racism, homophobia, sexism, and all of these things that divide the working class. That the working class has to struggle against these things just in order to make that revolution in the first place. As we unite as a class and cast off these divisions, that will itself make the revolution possible. By the way, Dave Campbell, Peace and Freedom Party. So first,
thank you, yeah.
Shahi.
I think that the revolution or the change has to be predicated on the idea of human complexity. We know throughout the world that all people have an ontology and a cosmology. So religion is pre-capitalist society. Pre-Western society, the idea of a transcendent existence resides in all people prior to the Industrial Revolution. So there's something about human beings that want to reach beyond the material world and talk about something else, something greater. There's some inspiration, some spark. How to reach people when people are imbued with the idea of religiosity. I taught at a university for many years, and just as this man has said about returning to Oregon and trying to reach people there, it is nearly, you will anger students when you talk, when you present, even though they enroll in a class where they know that you're going to talk about ideology and social construction, they come with the idea of the notions of selfhood that has been taught to them from the very beginning. So it's not enough to say that if we change this or we change that, you're going to change people, because people come with an idea of who they are and how the world is. So there's that cosmology, there's that ontology. You have to deal with that. So, and then we have the social history, the way this whole world that we live in, especially in the United States, the way it has been constructed in terms of the division of races. And that is part of people's identity, even though it may be one that a person doesn't want to acknowledge or participate in consciously, but it exists within the social fabric, and it exists within the people too. So I think that we must take into consideration the complexity of human beings, that in terms of memory capacity, in terms of consciousness, and in terms of ideals, because we do have them. And those are the things that make life worth living. Not only, we know, for example, in countries that practice social democracy, like Sweden, there was a woman who came 20 years ago to a philanthropic organization that I worked with to learn how to do philanthropy, because they did not have it in Sweden at that time. The reason she was coming was because in Sweden, even with the eradication of poverty and people having a high material existence, child care from birth through whatever age, care for the elderly, being able to go to school, be an artist, and have the state take care of you, they had a high suicide rate. They had a very high domestic violence rate. And she said that the reason she was coming, specifically the purpose of her need to find to how to do philanthropy in Sweden, was because they were terrorized by their youth. They had a youth violence problem. I said, you're kidding. We thought that if we got rid of poverty and we could have people could have education, we wouldn't have that. So that just says, okay, that just says about the complexity that it is the material, but it's something else too.
Okay, thank you. Bob.
Yeah, I'm Bob from San Diego. I think in order to understand the kind of transformative powers of a revolution on the working class, I mean, first of all, we have to understand what we're talking about revolution. Maybe this relates to Cuba a little, because I think we have a very different conception of what a working class revolution that will result in a working class self-emancipation means. In Cuba, for instance, there wasn't the ideas of socialism did not dominate that revolution. It was a national liberation movement against the dictatorship. The ideas of socialism kind of came into that when they needed the USSR to aid them after that revolution. And so it wasn't really and it was also something that was not born out of the self-emancipation of the working class. It was, a guerrilla army that took, basically took control. I think we have to understand that the revolution that we're talking about is a process. It's a process by which you have things like mass protests turning into mass strikes. And I think we understand that all those things have an enormous effect on consciousness. And, a class struggle in general affects consciousness, but I think a revolutionary uprising affects it just, tremendously more. And so, which is how we have to understand how we get from here to there, because I think a revolution is not necessary just because it's going to end happily, but also, I think, and also not just because it transforms consciousness. I think that's an extremely important part of it. I think the third component, though, is also it gives the working class, for the first time, a real sense of their own power in that they start organizing society on their own. They start running their own society. They start taking over their workplaces. They start running their cities and distributing necessary goods and things like that. And they start throwing up democratic organizations like we've seen in countless time and time again in working class uprisings in the modern era. They start building their own democratic organizations that elect leadership that's accountable, that comes from the ranks of the working class. I think all these things are forming the basis of the new society that has to come out of it. And so that I think it's really important, that we look at it as this process and not this single event that of insurrection or just kind of a one-off thing.
Thank you. I might have to start wrapping people up as we're getting closer to time, and also so Kurt can wrap up at the end. I'll have to cut off the list here too. We have enough speakers that'll fill up all this time on the list already. The person in the red shirt right here.
Yeah, I mean, I think the assumption I see with Marxism is, the way I look at it, is that actually we're, like some people have already said, like we have tons of different ideas about the world. Everyone has, different conceptions and interpretations and perspectives on the world and everything. Philosophy, ontology, all these things. Sexism, homophobia, the list could go on. I mean, I think the idea is that people's consciousness are constantly in flux and that we change very quickly. Like you were saying, we're very malleable creatures when conditions are changed and in our concrete experiences and lives, we change very rapidly. I mean, anti-Semitism was deeply ingrained in Russia But then very quickly in a revolutionary situation, you know, Jews made great gains. You know, 1871 in Paris, you know, the exploitation of women was very deeply ingrained, but then women were given the right to vote or whatever. I mean, my historical background, you know, great, but you see what I'm saying, like, so like religion, I mean, I think the idea is getting rid of the conditions that make those things rampant and widespread. If you accept the conclusion that, you know, religion, sexism, make sense within the type of society we're living in now, you know, it's the same thing with the state, right? If you can eliminate class exploitation and the existence of classes, period, then the state is superfluous, it withers away, right? I mean, I think it's the same thing with racism. You know, I think the rise of the institution of racism is connected up with the rise of capitalism anyways. You know, I think the same thing with sexism. That's the Marxist interpretation of oppression. It's connected up with class, and eliminating those class conditions will eventually lead to a situation where those things don't have to be so prominent.
Thank you.
Yes, hi, my name is Marit. I'm with Bay Area Radical Women. I just wanted to make note of, or just ask Dave, you know, I found it interesting what you said about the concept of that the working class itself needs to be united, and that the working class is actually divided by struggling against isms such as sexism.
No, it's divided by sexism.
Oh, I thought you were saying that.
And the struggle against those isms is the struggle to unite the working class.
Right. But my understanding among some groups on the left is that the struggle against racism, sexism, homophobia actually divides the working class.
They're wrong.
Well, that is my sense of it. And it isn't consistent with reality. That there is racism and sexism in the working class, and that has to be addressed in a real, full-on way.
I'm sorry if I gave the opposite impression.
We'll have to continue the debate afterwards. But I have John and then Christine in the back. And then
you know, in terms of ridiculous ideologies or whatever, I really feel like the belief in God is not really a big deal. Certainly compared to the belief in an invisible hand of the market.
Yeah.
That's a ridiculous ideology, right? And I'm bringing this up because, you know, I think, you know, sometimes we kind of fixate on disagreements that are, not that I don't want to say that we shouldn't have these discussions with people about social change and that sort of thing, but to think of like, oh my goodness, you know, meet someone who's religious, the first thing I've got to do is convince them there's no God before they're going to get involved in the movement. I think we're actually going to shoot ourselves in the foot. Because really, I mean, I think really what it comes down to is, you know, yeah, we can have a discussion about where religion comes from, how, you know, and the Marxist analysis of that in terms of, because it's a good debate in terms of understanding society and how society can change and ideas, and I think we're engaging in that. One thing that I want to bring up that I think is so important about how changing conditions can change consciousness, for instance, especially in this country, is the question of slavery, right? We used to have slavery in the U.S., right? And it was a state in which a majority of people in this country actually thought that was a natural condition. That, you know, there are people that would just, you know, the best you could hope for. I mean, at least it was better than living as savages in Africa. You know, that was the conception. Anyone says that today, they're a racist bigot. I mean, you know what I'm saying? Like, they're marginal. They're not the majority. It's because of changing conditions, because of changing, you know, a movement to change those conditions, that the ideas about slavery have changed so dramatically. We can talk, I mean, we were just talking the other day with Sherry Wolf, or actually, this was this morning, time flies, that the number of people that have come out of the closet has really transformed the way people look at LGBT issues and really are beginning to embrace that more and more in the wider society, you know. So there are these struggles. It's not just that revolution causes changes, but actual struggle can begin to have these changes in ideas. But I really wanted to go back to that idea. You know, religion is not the enemy.
Yeah.
Let's just to make that clear.
Okay,
Christina?
I think first, as a member of the ISO, I would agree that any organization that says that struggles against racism, sexism, homophobia, so on, divide the working class, that's dead wrong. So I would just agree on that. And then I wanted to say, I think what's been said about consciousness and ideas and how this change has been really fantastic and important and thorough. I just wanted to bring it back a little bit to how the Communist Manifesto and Marxism more broadly are based on understanding of material reality. So what relations in the economy and society actually look like and how what they look like and how they function together in a sort of dynamic system. How that influences our ideas and who we are as social beings. And in particular, going back to the manifesto, like looking at the concept of the conditions that capitalism brings about that are unique in history, in particular, looking at the way that the concentration of workers and workplaces, the people who create wealth in society, concentrated in the places where wealth is created, is significant. And as folks said, the struggle in the workplace, whether it's for economic changes or better working conditions, or for social justice, how that changes consciousness, that's important. But I think I just want to reiterate, we also have, as people who create wealth in society, we have our hands on our tremendous lever. That's one example that's always stood out to me. In 1996, two GM plants with a workforce of 3,200 workers struck for 15 days. Okay? They shut down GM's entire North American operations and cost the company $1 billion in profit, and they won that strike. That's tremendous power, I think. I mean, in the mid-90s, 3,200 people had stopped buying cars for 15 days. And then we could look at what's different now, maybe. But I think it would have been a drop in the bucket. These folks were looking at shut down their entire North American operations. That's something pretty significant.
Can you wrap up soon, Christine?
Sure. I think that to go back to something Kurt said, I mean, Mars and Engels didn't get everything right. They were limited by the material circumstances themselves. They didn't make castles in the sky. They didn't make prescriptions. They started with what things look like and explain them and describe them and explain them. I think just to quickly end on the question about the Russian Revolution, the victory of the Russian Revolution was based on these kind of class politics, this kind of understanding of how consciousness changes the folks that we're talking about, the understanding that socialism can only be won by a mass movement. And from there, they had to apply that theory to their own situation. The same thing in other revolutionary situations. Russia in 1917 is very different than Cuba. I'll end it there. The idea is that you have to take a theory, a lens,
thank you all. I hope the discussion continues after today. And just a quick announcement, this book is available downstairs, I believe, as well as at the Haymarket Room, which is at 110 Cap Street. Great.
If I could just say, if you've read the manifesto before, you know, other kind of editions, that's great. I would say you should get this book. The explanatory material in here is essential.
Exactly. Next will be dinner. There's a stand-up performance by Mark Steele at the ISO building. Go ahead and finish.
Yeah, I really want to also make a pitch for the manifesto, because as people can see with the variety of, you know, questions and things that came up, is that it really does cover a whole lot of thoughts. I mean, it is the founding, document of revolutionary socialism, and so obviously a lot in here that even in this really great discussion we could not get to. Just quickly, a lot of people have already said.
Can I just ask a question about the book really fast?
Yeah.
Was it edited, or the explanatory notes? Who wrote them? Is that a member of the ISO?
Yeah.
Okay.
It's Phil Gaspard. Yeah. Really helps explain a lot of stuff. And that's one of the great things about the annotated version is that, a lot of times people either find it challenging or not so much challenging, but just the fact that it was written in 1848, sometimes the, you know, vernacular and language is a bit different, and sometimes having an annotated version that helps clarify some things is definitely helpful. Just a few things I just wanted to point out. Some people already mentioned. Yeah, I mean, John's absolutely right about like the whole, you know, thought about religion. Religion is not the enemy on this. I mean, you know, I think there's this caricature about Marxism that, you know, gets bandied about that, you know, anti-religion or whatever else. And I think that, you know, with the way that the manifesto is written, it starts from a historical materialist conception. And so because of that, most Marxists are probably atheists because they understand, you know, how religion came about and the role it plays in the world. But by no means do we find that the enemy, nor that the people that we're either working with or trying to win over to these ideas, you know, have to be convinced of it. I mean, like John said, we're just shooting ourselves in the foot of that. There's no litmus test for who we're going to engage and struggle with. You know, so are we going to, say, keep Muslims that want to come out to, you know, protest what's going on in Israel and say, oh, no, no, you know, you're not an atheist, you can't come out here for that? Or will we stand opposed to, say, Malcolm X in the 1960s or MLK and the struggles that he was going about? I mean, absolutely not. It's just a sort of a ridiculous notion. And I guess also sort of for, I guess full disclosure, since sort of the idea about, you know, religion came up because of, about, you know, sort of the more conservative areas of this country. For full disclosure, I'm, you know, from originally Missouri, spent a great deal of my life in Kansas, as well as North Carolina. The really interesting thing about, you know, I think that what you see with, like, just this 2008 presidential campaign is that ideas really do change. And even if it's sort of a limited way within sort of the electoral politics, people were saying before, oh, no way that, you know, these quote-unquote red states are ever going to vote for a black candidate. You know, they're forever conservative and everything else. And what it really showed is that, you know, places that they didn't expect to go for Obama ended up going for Obama. And so I think the bottom line of that is that, and why I think that we should gain inspiration in the fact that workers can come to this consciousness, because actually a lot of the consciousness they have is false consciousness. And that's really a danger, I think, right now as well in an economic crisis, is that if we don't have active socialists out there helping to give an explanation about who is actually causes the problem of this, it's not immigrants, it's actually the bosses and the elite of this country, and actually giving a clear explanation of that, there is a real danger that things can go in the opposite direction, such as right-wing populism and, you know, immigrant bashing, gay bashing, and so forth, is really what the problem is. And just so people don't think that, you know, socialism somehow a foreign idea within the United States, and especially within more rural areas, when I mentioned Eugene Debs winning 1 million votes in 1920, where it was the largest registered population of socialists, well, it was in Oklahoma and areas like that. I mean, it's because of these, you know, same interests that, you know, working class people have in being able to fight, you know, a much larger exploiter. And so I just want to end on that, and so I think that really the bottom line with like the manifesto and why it sort of it bothers going through history and sort of like laying out sort of how class societies came about and, you know, where we're at today, how capitalism came about, is because really talks about how if class society had a historic beginning, then it can also have a historic end. So, I mean, I think that that's really in a nutshell sort of what the Communist Manifesto is all about, and it's really an inspiring read. Like I said before, I think many more people that are becoming more and more radicalized and are questioning this ridiculous system that's throwing people in the unemployment lines are going to really want to figure out an alternative to that system. I think we need to be able to explain that, and I think the manifesto is a great tool for being able to do that.